And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today's January 6th. Sixth day of the year. 359 days remain till the year's over with. I had someone try to tell me 2022 is a leap year. The next leap year is 2024. So, we've still got 365 days in this year. On this day in 1066, following the death of Edward the Confessor on January 5th, the Wheaton meet to confirm Harold Godwinson as the new King of England. He's crowned same day, sparking a succession crisis, eventually did a Norman conquest of England, where my ancestors came in and took over. 1205, Philip of Swabia undergoes a second coronation as King of the Romans. 1322, Stephen Uroš III is crowned King of Serbia, having defeated his half-brother Stefan Konstantin in battle. His son is crowned the young king in the same ceremony. 1355, Charles IV of Bohemia is crowned with the Iron Crown of Lombardy as the King of Italy in Milan. 1449, Constantine the 11th is crowned Byzantine Emperor at Mestres. 1492, the Catholic monarchs Ferdinand and Isabella enter Granada at the conclusion of the Granada War. 1536, the first European school of higher learning in the Americas, Colegio de Santa Cruz de Tratiloco, is founded by Viceroy Antonio de Mendoza and Bishop Juan de Zamboranga in Mexico City. 1540, King Henry VIII of England marries Anne of Cleves. 1579, a union of Arras unites the southern Netherlands under the Duke of Parma, Ottavio Farnese, governor in the name of King Philip II of Spain. 1641, Arauco War. The first Parliament of Quilon is celebrated, putting a temporary hold on hostilities between Mapuches and the Spanish in Chile. 1661, English Restoration. The fifth monarchist unsuccessfully attempt to seize control of London. The revolt is suppressed after just a few days. The fifth monarchist were an extreme Puritan sect active from 1649 to 1660. During the Commonwealth of England. That was following the English Civil Wars of the 17th century. They took their name from a prophecy in the book of Daniel that four ancient monarchies, Babylonian, Persian, Macedonian, and Roman, would precede the kingdom of Christ. They also referred to the year 1666 in relationship with the biblical number of the beast, indicating the end of earthly rule by carnal human beings. They were one of a number of nonconformist dissenting groups that emerged about that same time. After the Restoration, October 14, 1660, Major General Thomas Harrison was the first person to be tried and found guilty of regicide in the killing of Charles I. He'd been the 17th of 59 commissioners to sign the death warrant of the king in 1649. And he was the first regicide to be hung, drawn, and quartered because he was considered by the new government to represent a continued real threat to the reestablished order. Now, this threat was realized on January 6, 1661, when 50 fifth monarchists, headed by a wine cooper named Thomas Venner and thought to have been hiding out in Norton Folgate, made an effort to attain possession of London in the name of King Jesus. Most of the 50 were either killed or taken prisoner. On the 19th and 21st of January, Venner and 10 others were hung, drawn, and quartered for high treason. And the failure of this uprising led to repressive legislation to suppress nonconformist sects. All in the name of religion. 1721, the Committee of Injury on the South Sea Bubble publishes its findings, revealing details of fraud among company directors and corrupt politicians. A lot of very wealthy families lost a bundle in the what was called the South Sea Bubble. 1781, in the Battle of Jersey, the British defeat the last attempt by France to invade Jersey and the Channel Islands. 1809, combined British, Portuguese, and colonial Brazilian forces begin the invasion of Cayenne during the Napoleonic Wars. 1838, Alfred Vail and colleagues demonstrate a telegraph system using dots and dashes. Now, this was not Morse code. This was the forerunner of Morse code. 1839, the night of the big wind, the most damaging storm in 300 years, sweeps across Ireland, damaging and destroying more than 20% of the houses in Dublin. 1847, Samuel Colt obtains the first contract for the sale of revolver pistols to the U.S. government. 1870, inauguration of the Musikverein in Vienna, Austria, was on this date. The Musikverein is a concert hall in the Innerstadt borough of Vienna, Austria. It's the home of the Vienna Philharmonic. It was considered the concert hall in the world for quite a long time. 1893, the Washington National Cathedral is chartered by Congress. Charter signed by President Benjamin Harrison. 1900, the Second Boer War. Having already besieged the fortress at Ladysmith, Boer forces attack it but are driven back by the British defenders. 1907, Maria Montessori opens her first school and daycare center for working class children in Rome. 1912, New Mexico is admitted to the Union as the 47th U.S. state. 1912, German geophysicist Alfred Wegener first presents his theory of continental drift. 1929, King Alexander of the Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes suspends his country's constitution. It's known as the January 6th dictatorship. We had that here, but Pelosi was running the show. 1929, Mother Teresa arrives by sea in Calcutta, India, to begin her work among India's poorest and sick people. 1930, Classic Cummins arrives at the National Automobile Show in New York City, having driven a car powered by one of his diesel engines all the way from Indianapolis. 1941, U.S. President Roosevelt delivers his Four Freedoms speech in a State of the Union address. 1946, the first general election ever held in Vietnam is held on this date. 1947, Pan American Airlines becomes the first commercial airline to offer a round-the-world ticket. 1950, the UK recognizes the People's Republic of China. Republic of China severs diplomatic relations with UK in response. When it says it's the People's Republic, you can replace that with the word communist. 1951, Korean War, beginning of the Ganghwa Massacre, in the course of which an estimated 200 to 1,300 South Korean communist sympathizers are slaughtered. 1960, National Airlines Flight 2511 is destroyed midair by a bomb all en route from New York City to Miami. Also in 1960, the association laws come into force in Iraq. Allowing registration of political parties. 1967, Vietnam War. U.S. Marine Corps and Arvin troops launch Operation Deckhouse 5 in the Mekong River Delta. Arvin are the Army of the Republic of Vietnam, who, as soon as we weren't there, ran so fast the hounds couldn't catch him down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. 1974, in response to the 1973 oil crisis, daylight saving times commences nearly 4 months early in the U.S. 1989, Satwant Singh and Kara Singh are sentenced to death for conspiracy to assassinate Prime Minister Indira Gandhi. They're executed the same day. 1992, President of Georgia, Javed Gamsakhurdia, flees the country as a result of the military coup. 1993. Excuse me. Indian Border Security Forces units kill 55 Kashmiri civilians in Sopore, Jammu, and Kashmir in revenge after militants ambush a Border Security Force patrol. Also in 93, four people are killed when Lufthansa CityLine Flight 5634 crashes on approach to Charles de Gaulle Airport in Roissy in France. 1994, American figure skater Nancy Kerrigan is attacked and injured by an assailant hired by her rival Tanya Harding's ex-husband during the U.S. Figure Skating Championship. She was hit in the knee with a bat, as I remember. 1995, shortly after that, Tanya Harding made a most interesting sex tape. The 1995, a chemical fire in an apartment complex in Manila, Philippines, led to the discovery of plans for Project Bohinca, a mass terrorist attack. 2005, American Civil Rights Movement. Edgar Ray Killen is indicted for the 1964 murders of Cheney, Goodman, and Swerner. Also 2005, a train collision in Grantville, South Carolina releases about 60 tons of chlorine gas. 2012, 26 people killed and 63 wounded when a suicide bomber blows himself up at a police station in Damascus. 2017, five people are killed and six others injured in a mass shooting at Fort Lauderdale, Hollywood International Airport in Broward County, Florida. 2019, 40 people are killed in a gold mine collapse in Badakhshan province in northern Afghanistan. 2019, Muhammad V of Kelantan resigns as the Yang di Pertuan Anggong of Malaysia, becoming the first monarch to do so. 2021, supporters of President Donald Trump attacked the United States Capitol to disrupt certification of the 2020 presidential election, resulting in five deaths and evacuation of the U.S. Congress. Now, what's interesting is one of the main instigators turned out to be Pelosi's son-in-law. But you don't hear anything about that. Oh, no. Her and her family are sacred in this country. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances, Armed Forces Day in Iraq. Christian feast days. Andre Bessette, the Roman Catholic Church. It's Christmas in the Armenian Apostolic Church. It's Christmas Eve in Russia. Christmas Eve in Ukraine. Christmas Eve in Bosnia and Herzegovina. And Christmas Eve in North Macedonia. It's the Epiphany, or Three Kings Day in Western Christianity. Theophany in Eastern Christianity. Befana Day in Italy. Little Christmas in Ireland, Pretandin in Iceland, and Petit Lao Day in Laos. The most interesting thing is I was listening to a snippet of CNN, and a year after he left office, he's still being attacked by Trump is still being attacked by CNN because attacking Trump raises ratings, and their ratings are so bad. I often wondered why people play games on a telephone. that call, which came in on a line that's supposed to give me news stories, they just sat and breathed. Well, this is the anniversary of the attack on the Capitol. And Sleepy Joe is making a speech today where he's blaming the whole thing on Trump. I don't know what they're going to do when they don't have Trump to kick around anymore. Yeah, I'm sure they'll think of some other person to attack to try to take your attention off their failures. Let's see. Okay. 1017, Canute the Great, crowned King of England in London at Lifing, Archbishop of Canterbury. He was the King of England, Denmark, and Norway. It's interesting nobody's heard of him that I know of. 1099, Henry V, crowned German King. 1227, Ferrand of Portugal, freed from the Louvre. 1352, the French King Jean II introduces the Order of the Star. 1494, the first Mass in the New World is celebrated at La Isabella in Hispaniola. 1679, more than half... Netherlands counties of Artois and Hainaut and the city of Dallas signed a pro-Spanish and pro-Roman Catholic Union of Arras agreement. I can't talk. 1617, English court favorite George Villiers is made Earl of Buckingham by King James I. He was also known as James I and James VI. He was the King of Great Britain, which included being King of Scotland. 1639, Virginia is the first colony to order surplus crops destroyed. It was tobacco. 1681, the first recorded boxing match is set up by Christopher Monk, the second Duke of Albemarle. In that match, his butler faced his butcher. 1690, Joseph I, later proclaimed Holy Roman Emperor and the son of Emperor Leopold I, becomes King of the Romans. 1745, Bonnie Prince Charlie's army draws to Glasgow. He was a pretender to the British throne. 1773, Massachusetts slaves petition the legislature to grant them freedom. 1784, Turkey and Russia sign a treaty in Constantinople. 1838, Samuel Morse and Alfred Vail demonstrate their telegraph machine in New Jersey. 1853, Franklin Pierce, the president-elect of the U.S. at that time, and his family are involved in a train wreck in Massachusetts. 1857, a patent for reducing zinc ore is granted to Samuel Wetherill in Pennsylvania. 1861, Florida troops seized the federal arsenal at Apalachicola. 1873, Pope Pius IX publishes an encyclical called On the Church in Armenia. 1873, U.S. Congress begins investigating the Credit Mobilier scandal involving financier and railroad promoter Doc Durant. 1887, Abd Allah II of Harar opens the Battle of Shilinko with an attack on the camp of the Swalian army of Negus Menelik II, Emperor of Ethiopia. 1893, the Great Northern Railway connects Seattle with the East Coast. 1896, the first U.S. women's six-day bicycle race starts at Madison Square Garden. 1898, the first telephone message from a submerged submarine was done by Simon Lake. 1913, attempting to end the hostilities in the Balkans, the London Peace Conference breaks down because Turkey refuses to cede Adrianople, the Aegean Island, and Crete. 1914, Merrill Lynch is founded. 1921, the Iraqi Army is formed. 1925, Mikhail Frunze replaces Leon Trotsky as People's Commissar of Military and Native Affairs. Trotsky and Stalin battle for power in the aftermath of Lenin's death. Stalin won. Trotsky left the country, eventually was assassinated, I think, in Mexico. 1927, U.S. Marines return to Nicaragua. 1929, Alexander I establishes a royal dictatorship in Yugoslavia. 1931, on this date, Thomas Edison submitted his last patent application. Well, we have been talking about haunted hotels for the last few shows. You know, the Old West has quite a number of them. We're going to start out with Las Vegas, New Mexico, the Plaza Hotel. Now, Byron Mills was a prominent Las Vegas attorney and abstractor who owned the Plaza Hotel during most of the first half of the 1900s. He arrived in Las Vegas in 1852, just after the Landmark Hotel was completed, and took over ownership 36 years later. Now, according to the January 1945 issue in the Mexico magazine, he began to dismantle the hotel and sell its furniture in anticipation of demolishing the three-story structure. Now, nowhere in that article does it explain his motives, but it did give considerable space to his knowledgeable discourse on the hotel's history. He's even quoted as saying, "I feel almost guilty about the demolition." Now, for some unknown reason, Mills never followed through with his plan. In fact, some folks speculate a disembodied Byron T. Mills haunts the hotel today out of a sense of guilt. Others believe he remains because he loved the hotel more than he claimed in a lifetime. There's a third group suggests the hotel's historic resident ghost simply enjoys the company of others, especially women. And that may explain both the reported presence of a man coupled with the sudden scent of perfume that's quite often encountered in the hotel. Now, a number of the stories of haunting seem to come from room 310. When one lady traveling alone has reported the presence of a man in her room. And almost everybody would agree the Spirit of Mills has a special fondness for women who are alone in their rooms, and as well as traveling salesmen. One particular salesman checked into his room on the third floor, dropped his bags, went directly to the bathroom. When he got out, he noticed the door's deadbolt was locked. He thought that was funny because he didn't remember locking the door. He then undressed for a shower, put his money under his clothes, piled everything next to the sink. When he got out, he found his money on top of the clothes. Another employee, who was staying in one of the third-floor rooms for a time, said she was awakened in the early morning hours by a door opening and footsteps crossing the room. Then she felt the weight of somebody sitting down on her bed. Well, she sat up and didn't see anything. Tried to go back to sleep, but until 5 a.m. when her husband finally came back, she actually heard the sound of somebody pacing back and forth across the room. Other employees report feeling cigar smoke in the bar and hearing heavy boots walking when there was nobody there. Now, the hotel bar was also the scene of another of Byron's pranks. According to one story, there were a couple of devout Catholics who, after church one Good Friday, decided to go out to the bar and have a few drinks. They were sitting on the patio, feeling a little guilty to be spending that holy day in such a frivolous way when a drop of blood fell out of nowhere and landed on the white tablecloth. Well, they decided discretion was the better part of valor, and they got the heck out of Dodge. And it was said they didn't indulge in liquor on Good Friday ever again. And one of my favorite places, of course, is the Lodge in Cloudcroft, New Mexico. Now, the Lodge was originally constructed in the rustic mountain community of Cloudcroft by the Alamogordo and Sacramento Mountain Railway in 1899. It was owned and operated by the railroad and intended to be a resort for workers who were the byproduct of the railway's search for timber. And it was immediately successful. Its breathtaking location in the lushly wooded Sacramento Mountain offers a cool welcome retreat to literally thousands of heat-punished Texans, New Mexico, and New Mexicans, Oklahomans, and Arizonans, even though New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Arizona weren't states at the time the lodge was built. One article published in the Albuquerque Journal Democrat near the completion of the lodge in 1899 stated this beautiful building would be known as Cloudcroft Lodge and its interior be furnished with a lavish hand, yet in keeping with the character of the place. Fireplaces with wide hungry mouths will sparkle, crackle, and dart forth welcome tongues of flame to hundreds of merry guests. They'll find new pleasure in life during the long, sultry summer. 1908, the El Paso and Southwestern Railroad System took over ownership, and they advertised at the hotel, restaurant, dancing pavilion, tennis court, golf links, bowling alley, billiard parlor, burro trips. Children's playground were accessible for weekend rates of $3 a round trip. And at the lodges, rates were $12.50 and up per week. Now, I would suggest to you that for the time, those were very reasonable prices. Well, on June 13, 1909, a fire blazed through the lodge, early destroyed it. But by 1911, the lodge was completely rebuilt and reopened on its current site, and its appearance has remained virtually the same since that time. It's been called a historic timeless gem suspended in time. Over the long history of the lodge, has played host to numerous famous people such as Pancho Villa, Gilbert Rowland, Judy Garland, Clark Gable. In fact, Judy Garland and Clark Gable carved their names into the wall of the lodge's tower, where they can be seen to this day. But of course, the most infamous guest of all at the lodge is the ghost of the lovely Rebecca. Now, Rebecca's become one of the most famous ghosts in New Mexico. This lovely young lady was a chambermaid at the lodge and reputedly disappeared from the premises sometime in the 1920s or early 30s. And they claim this restless ghost has made her presence known here ever since her death. Now, she was said to be a gorgeous red-haired chambermaid who worked and lived in the lodge in the 20s and 30s. And similar to her fellow lodge employees, she lived in the employees' rooms, which were located in the basement at the time. And by all accounts, she was a very friendly, flirtatious young lady and unforgettably lovely. There were some rumors that Rebecca moonlighted as a prostitute, although no proof has ever been submitted to support this claim. Whatever might be the case, according to the story, her jealous lumberjack boyfriend caught her in the arms of another man at the lodge. It's said it happened in room 101, also known as the governor's suite, and he became enraged. Shortly after this, Rebecca disappeared from the lodge, never to be seen again. Well, she hadn't been seen alive, that is. Soon after her disappearance, people began to report having some very strange, even ghostly experiences. You know, over the years, there have been many sightings of an auburn-haired apparition floating through the halls, a vision seen by both employees and guests alike. One guest heard scraping sounds in the hallway late one night and opened the door to see a red-haired woman in a 30s-style nightdress rearranging flowers in a vase on top of an antique chest. Another guest was shocked when he went to take a shower and he found a vaporous female reclining in his bathtub. And there have also been reports of objects such as watches and ashtrays and silverware sliding across surfaces untouched. Doors opening and closing on their own, lights and other appliances turning on and off by themselves. Furniture's moved inexplicably. Even faucets have turned on and toilets have flushed for no apparent reason. Maybe one of the strangest events happened on one Halloween night when a man dressed in a tuxedo came into the lodge's dining room and sat alone at an intimate two-chair table. He ordered two dinners and two glasses of wine. Everybody in the room watched closely as the man ate his meal and carried on a conversation with someone who wasn't there. No one ever saw anyone sit with the man or even go near him, but at the end of the meal, both wine glasses and both plates were empty. Something ate that meal. Now, Rebecca's manifestations are many. One of her favorite hangouts is the Red Dog Saloon, an all-west style saloon with a rough-hewn walls and southwest decor, which is located in the basement where the employee showers used to be. This is a very active spot as the lights go on and off untouched. Even more mysteriously, 1930s-era poker chips have been mysteriously found in the middle of a floor, which had been clear only a few minutes before. Ashtrays have been reported moving by themselves, and flames appear in the fireplace with no logs or other sources of fuel visible. Lodge patrons have called the front desk to complain about the loud music coming from the saloon at times when the saloon is empty and, in fact, wasn't even open. Others have reported seeing an apparition of a twirling woman who's been seen on the dance floor. One bartender claimed to have seen the reflection of a beautiful red-haired woman wearing a long dress in the mirror behind the bar. But there was no woman there when the bartender turned around to look at her. Excuse me. I don't know why I'm coughing so much. Now, another paranormal hotspot seems to be found in the tower. That's a three-story structure that stands tall above the lodge itself. Now, the lodge is kept locked with two levels of small sitting rooms with windows that give a panoramic view of the mountains. Others reported feeling cold spots and a presence in the tower, and the third floor, which is where the locked door leading to the tower can be found, is reportedly very paranormally active as well. Now, additionally, there's said to be a lot of activity surrounding Room 101, which is, as I said earlier, referred to as the Governor's Suite. Some have theorized Rebecca carried on her tryst in this room and maybe even caught in the act there by her lumberjack boyfriend one day. Whatever the connection, the staff at the lodge has gotten calls from Room 101 when nobody's at the other end, even when there's nobody in the room at the time. Despite having a modern computerized phone system, the phone calls from Room 101 continue to this day. The light in the ceiling fan just outside Room 101 is also said to turn on and off at will. Former housekeeper claimed that after making up a bed, she would come back only to find an indentation if somebody just laid or sat down. She said that guest shoes would mysteriously move a few rooms down from where they were supposed to be. It would seem even in spectral form, Rebecca's a very fun-loving, mischievous spirit. To this day, employees and guests alike are still reporting strange and mysterious encounters at the lodge. There have been a number of reports that the toilets in the ladies' room have been flushing by themselves earlier that day. Whether you believe in Rebecca or not, the lodge is still an amazing, unique place with a ton of fascinating history. The forest scenery and mountain views are unbelievable, and the lodge itself is a graceful and timeless treat, lavishly furnished with the Victorian and country lodge decor of a bygone era. And there's even a fabulous restaurant called, well, what else would it be called? Rebecca's. So I highly recommend, if you want a treat, go spend some time at the lodge. Then in Socorro, New Mexico, we have the Valverde Hotel. Now, built in 1915, the Valverde is not as large as other business hostelries in New Mexico. but from a standpoint of beauty and convenience, it's without peer. It contains 60 guest rooms, a commodious dining room, a kitchen, a lobby, and a writing room. With the exception of a few grander suites, the room shared two common bathrooms located on the second floor. Each room is equipped with its own shower. In present times, the rooms are rented out as apartments, with two of the old rooms composing one apartment. Kitchen and dining room was converted to a restaurant while the old lobby is now a bar. Inside the building, one staircase leads to the upper floor. This door is locked, so access to the second floor is by two fire escapes located at the rear of the building. And there are stairs for the tenants used to access their apartments. Now, I believe this is the one that a friend of mine just bought. His name is Jim Burleson. Now, there's been a great deal of activity that takes place in the stairs leading to the second floor. Randomly flashing lights and small orbs can be seen whisking about with infrared cameras. The activity only seems to take place when a live band is playing, and even then only if it's earth-based music with such instruments as violins and harmonicas. Maybe sound vibrations somehow summon the spirits from where they normally reside. Others have said that the spirits of an unidentified woman has also been seen on the stairs and on the landing. And though efforts have been made to identify this unknown figure, to date, nobody's been able to give her a name. During its long history, a total of 10 people have died in various locations within the hotel. 5 of these deaths were thought to be suicides. Now, from the Val Verde, let's go to Fort Craig. One of a number of military posts built prior to the Civil War. These were built to protect the settlers from marauding Indians. It also came to prominence during the Confederate invasion of New Mexico. When the 11 states seceded from the Union in 1861 and formed the Confederate States of America, the Confederacy was desperately short of raw material for war production. These materials had to be imported from abroad and often paid for in gold, and of course gold and seaports became very important to the South. Now, the Confederacy was very much aware that California and the western part of North America had both seaports and gold, and the South wanted them. So a plan was devised to allow the Confederacy to both achieve the means to purchase raw materials and also to cut the government of the U.S. off from its western territories. In the summer of 1861, the 2nd Texas Regiment, Mounted Rifles, led by Colonel John Baylor, seized control of the Mesilla Valley. This was near present-day Las Cruces, and declared New Mexico a Confederate territory. In the winter of 1861, a Confederate brigade invaded New Mexico with the hope of fulfilling the South's ambitions in the West. Now, the brigade was commanded by General Henry Sibley, formerly of the U.S. Army, and was comprised of 3 regiments of cavalry, the 4th, 5th, and 7th Texas Mounted Volunteers, and an independent battery of artillery. That was about 3,000 men and 18 cannon. Opposing the Sibley Brigade were a few companies of the 5th and 7th U.S. Infantry, a few companies of the 2nd Cav, a battalion of the 3rd Cavalry, a few batteries of artillery, and 1 company of Colorado Volunteers, several regiments of New Mexico Volunteers, and some untried militia. The overall command of the U.S. forces was Colonel Edward Canby. Now, the first battle of the campaign was south of Socorro near Fort Craig at Val Verde Ford. Texas drove the Federal forces from the field and captured a battery of cannons in the savage encounter that saw the only documented use of Lancers in the war between the states. Now, Canby retreated to Fort Craig and Sibley couldn't get him to come out. Texas lost many supply wagons in a surprise cavalry charge by the New Mexico Volunteers. So short on supply, Sibley chose to bypass Fort Craig and continue north to Albuquerque. Now, Albuquerque was occupied March 2, 1862, and Santa Fe was March 7. Confederates are critically short of food and other supplies needed to federal stores at Fort Union on the Santa Fe Trail north of Las Vegas, New Mexico. Fort Union, there were about 1,300 federal troops, including several companies of regulars and New Mexico Volunteers, but mainly the newly organized 1st Colorado Volunteers known as the Pike Speakers. 1st Colorado arrived at Fort Union after a Herculean effort, including a march through a blizzard. The fort and its troops are commanded by Colonel John Slaw. Slaw's order from Canby was to protect Fort Union at all costs, but not to start a major battle. So Saul thought the best place from which to defend Fort Union was on the road to Santa Fe, so he started down the road toward Goleta Pass. On March 26th, the force of about 400 Confederates under the command of Major Charles Pyron was scouting the western end of Glorieta Pass, which was called Apache Canyon. He rounded a bend and ran into Slaw's advance party of about 415 men under the command of Major Chivington. Chivington attacked at once and drove the Confederates down the canyon in a wild running fight and captured dozens of Texans. Fearing the entire Confederate brigade was close behind, he halted his men and withdrew to Kozlowski's ranch near Pecos. Major Byron fell back to Wood and Water, two critical items in New Mexico during early spring, and sent for help. His courier found Lieutenant Colonel William Scurry at Callisto, just going into camp with two battalions of the brigade. So within minutes, Scurry would put his men on the road to Apache Canyon. An all-night march through bitter cold brought him to Byron's position before about dawn. Texas prepared for a federal assault and waited through the 27th. At Kozlowski's, Slaw and Chivington decided on their plan of attack. Chivington would take about two-thirds of the troops, including all the artillery, down the pass towards Santa Fe. Chivington would take his battalion of 113, guided by Lieutenant Colonel J. Francisco Chavez and the New Mexico Volunteers over the shoulder, Glorieta Mason, attack the Confederate flank. So on the morning of the 28th, the plan was put into effect. Now, Scurry decided not to wait at Apache Canyon, so he started almost all his force, including Pyron's men, eastward through the pass. Left his supply wagons with a small guard at Johnson's Ranch at the junction of the Glorieta Pass and Apache Canyon. About mid-morning, he hit Slaw's elite elements near Pigeon's Ranch, which is located on the Santa Fe Trail. Scurry deployed his men in a long line and set his artillery up on a low hill. Slaw did the same thing, and though his line was shorter than Scurry, since Scurry's force had over 300 more men as Slaw did. Scurry's battalions attacked with great vigor, but were met with equal vigor by the Coloradans. Slaw's position wasn't strong, but the attack was stopped long enough to give his men time to fall back to a better one. Slaw tried to send men to his right around Scurry's flank, but a detachment of Texans met his men head-on and stopped them. Scurry kept pressure on Slaw's line, who organized his own force into the three-prong assault. Late in the afternoon, the Confederates attacked Slaw's entire front, driving into flanks and threatening the center. Outnumbered infantry, Federal infantry held the Texans at bay long enough for the artillery to pull back to a third line. Scurry's men pursued, but were exhausted from a six-hour battle. Slaw soon abandoned this line, leaving the Confederates in undisputed possession of the field. Okay, as you might guess, when you're dealing with a battle, quite often there are ghost stories that pop up about the battle. And I've been to a number of old military posts and researching for my books, and I've written 60-some-odd. In each, I felt a sense of purpose as if something about those who once served this country still remain. And so does it seem that those who garrisoned Fort Craig and tried to stop the depredations of both marauding Indians as well as the Confederate forces still stand ready to defend their country and the walls of Fort Craig. Now, some who visited Craig late in the evening report as they approach seeing figures that appear to be blue-clad sentries manning the walls. Of course, when they arrive at the site, they don't see anybody. One individual reported he was there about dusk and was absolutely sure he had heard the faint sounds of taps floating on the breeze. Figures and glowing orbs have been sighted around the commander's quarters and along officers' row. And I'm told that one group set up a tape recorder and recorded the sounds of a voice counting cadence as the rhythmic sounds of men marching could be heard in the background. And then, of course, there are the sounds of bits jingling and leather creaking that you would hear with cavalry. Just as I found at Fort Bliss, Texas, apparently there are those who will not leave their post until the great commander relieves them of their duty. There have been a number of reports that gunshots have been heard, and several have been adamant that gunshots came from muskets. Others have reported hearing what sounds like cannon fire. And I've also read reports that some witnesses have smelled the distinctive aroma of black powder. If you've ever smelled it, you cannot mistake it. that distinctive smell of black powder pistol or rifle fire is unmistakable. So if you want the opportunity to perhaps see some ghosts, I would recommend going to Fort Craig. Let's go to Nevada. The community of Austin. Sometimes unusual incidents are the reason good things happen. And such is the case with the little town of Austin, Nevada. The silver deposits that gave birth to this town were actually discovered in 1862 by a horse belonging to a W.H. Talbot. The horse, by accident, picked up a piece of quartz containing gold and silver. And Talbot, of course, sent the piece to Virginia City for assay. And once he got the report, he staked out a claim, and when word got out, others followed, and the silver rush was on. By 1880, the mines began to show signs of exhaustion, and its total of $50 million in ore production was soon history. Once difficult to reach, Austin is now immediately accessible on Highway 50. One of the early Nevada mining towns has remained comparatively unspoiled. Now, in addition to the history can be glimpsed along the streets of this remnant of the past, there are also ghosts that are said to haunt some of the old buildings. And one of these buildings is the old International Hotel. Now, the history of this hotel is certainly interesting. I've been told the building that became the hotel was originally built in Virginia City before being moved to Austin in 1862. In fact, this building is said to be the oldest building in Nevada. Many concerts and large balls were held upstairs in the Grand Ballroom. Emma Nevada, world-famous European opera singer, made her debut appearance here to a sold-out audience. And today, this historic old landmark is known as International Cafe and Bar, and it serves outstanding food. Now, in addition to the food and spirits it serves by day, there's said to be a number of spirits that haunt the old hotel by night. Now, the primary ghost is called Tommy, and it's believed to be the spirit of a former owner or maybe an employee. He's said to often be seen or his presence felt at the end of the bar and can be heard stomping around upstairs in the old hotel. If you want to meet a ghost, maybe go and see if you can spend some time with Tommy. Then we've got the Border City Hotel. Now, there are a few individuals who seem to be able to see into the future. And one of these was a man by the name of Jim Webb. When word began to circulate about the huge project being undertaken, he had visions of what Boulder City needed. A grand dame hotel with unprecedented private baths, air conditioning, and a gumwood paneled lobby that would accommodate world dignitaries visiting the Boulder Dam. Well, his vision became a reality, and during the 1930s, the Boulder Dam Hotel was a huge draw for people visiting Boulder Dam, and movie stars needed to establish Nevada residents so they could get the famous quickie divorces. The building was truly one of the most elegant modern hotels in the western U.S., and the gala grand opening was unlike any extravaganza attended by the elite society, or those that feel they are elite. Some of the famous guests during 1934 included A.P. Giannini, founder of Bank of America, Betty Davis, who stayed at the hotel while on vacation following the filming of Human Bondage, and the cast and crew of RKO Films, who stayed while they produced the movie Silver Streak. During 1935, a few of the more famous guests staying at the hotel included honeymooners Mr. and Ms. Cornelius Vanderbilt Jr., Will Rogers, who was performing on stage at the Boulder Theater, the Maharaj and Maharani of Indore, India, Cardinal Pascali, who later became Pope Pius XII. Throughout the remainder of the 30s, other famous guests would include a trip to the Great Dam and their travels that included the Duchess of Westminster, George Pepperdine, founder of Pepperdine University, Henry Fonda, Boris Karloff, who became world famous as the Mummy, Senator Robert Taft, Shirley Temple, Howard Hughes, who recuperated at the hotel after wrecking his airplane on Lake Mead. Now, what's interesting is that some of these guests have never checked out. Been in reports of apparitions, some of them very recognizable individuals indeed. Then we have the Beehive Whorehouse. Now, most places where there have been large amounts of activity seem to retain the imprint of those that spent a great deal of time there. And certainly a brothel would qualify as a place where folks spend a great deal of time. In Carson City, Nevada, there's a brothel known as the Beehive Whorehouse that's known to be haunted by those who have gone before, so to speak. The ghost of a tall, bloated woman with straggly red hair and dressed in a dirty white nightgown had been seen on the streets near the whorehouse where she once lived and plied her trade. Her name, according to those that claimed to know, was Timber Kate, and she was part of a notorious saloon act with a female lover, Bella Rawhide. The two performed live sex acts in honky-tonks in Carson City, Spokane, Butte, and Cheyenne. But the young Bella fell in love with a half-breed ruffian the name of Tug Daniels. And after Bella and Tug ran away together, Timber Kate resorted to dressing as a man in white tights and lifting weights on stage, though she usually ended up in a bizarre striptease. In 1880, Bella and Tug met up with Kate in Carson City. In the ensuing showdown, Tug pulled a knife and cut open Kate's belly from her crotch to her navel. The woman died in excruciating pain on the whorehouse floor. Now, Tug escaped and was never seen again. In 1882, Bella committed suicide by drinking cleaning fluid. Sign of the old Beehive Whorehouse is on North Quincy Street, but Timber Kate's ghost has been seen on many of the streets nearby. Then we've got the Amargosa Opera House and Hotel. Began life as a community center known as Cork Hill Hall. And Cork Hill Hall has been converted into a hotel that contained a theater now named the Amargosa Hotel. 1967, it was pretty much deserted when a dancer from New York by the name of Marta Beckett came upon it en route to an engagement. She was smitten by the possibility she saw in the ruined theater built the year she was born. On a shoestring, she leased and then bought the complex. A number of benefactors helped her. The Amargosa is now owned by a nonprofit organization, but she was the one who provided the energy to restore the theater in the hotel, and her personality permeates everything and makes a visit there a very special experience. Along with hotel and theater, Marta also seems to have purchased several ghosts, at least according to a number of psychics and the local tales told by the folks living in the area. Among the tales of ghosts and hauntings are, according to legend, in an unused area of the hotel, which was actually a mine shaft, where employees of the Pacific Coast Borax Company lived, there was either a murder or a suicide. Room 34, it's reported, a little girl named Mary was murdered. When you entered the room, it's possible to see a tall figure by the window that was said to be the killer. Guests who merely walked past the door to room 34 also report experiencing a strange feeling. Then the theater itself is also said to be haunted. Most people upon entering the theater report feeling a very unusual sensation said to be linked to the ghost. Well, there are a lot of stories about this historical hotel and opera house. Owner seems content to allow them to continue to stay there, but many have come to visit. Even Chris Angel did a show segment from the old hotel that aired October 31st, 2006. Well, let's talk about the Goldfield Hotel. It's closed off and abandoned with no access to the public. You can walk around the front along sidewalks, look in the windows. It's been partially remodeled over the years in a failed casino conversion project. Maybe someday an investor with enough funds will follow through and restore it properly, but so much major work has already been done to alter it for other projects, it would be very difficult to restore to what it once was. Built on top of an abandoned gold mine, this 154-room hotel was opened in 1908. It's considered home to several ghosts. In the downstairs employees area, room 109 is a small room with a single bed. It's haunted by the presence of a pregnant woman. Psychics have seen her ghost chained to a radiator there. Rumors say a pregnant prostitute named Elizabeth was chained in the room by George Winfield, the original owner of the hotel. After she gave birth, she was left to die in the room, and the baby is thrown down the old mine shaft at the north end of the basement. Elizabeth's ghost even turned up in a photograph taken in the room by a reporter from Las Vegas. On the first floor, the George Winfield room is said to be haunted by his ghost. Untraceable cigar smoke and fresh ashes have been found there. George's presence has also been detected near the lobby staircase, where the ghost of a midget and two small children have also been seen. Then the gold room is haunted by a ghost that stabs people. High psychic energy has been detected in the Theodore Roosevelt room and a southwest room on the third floor. Some psychics say the Goldfield Hotel is one of only seven portals to the other side that exist in the modern world. Who knows what you can find if you explore it. Then we have the Gold Hill Hotel. Built in 1859 as the Raisin House, the Gold Hill Hotel is the oldest operating hotel and saloon in the state of Nevada.
located just outside of Virginia City. Visitors arriving in Virginia City from either Lake Tahoe or Reno areas pass by this small town en route to Virginia City. It's also a stop on a 35-minute train tour of the Virginia and Truckee Railroad Tour. H.M. Vesey acquired the hotel there in the 1860s and added the wooden structure to the original stone building. The hotel became an important part of the now thriving metropolis of Gold Hill, which was adjacent to the even larger industrial and business center known as Virginia City. At least two ghosts are said to reside here. First, there's William, a firefighter who died in the Yellow Jacket fire. Guests at the hotel have been known to smell his pipe tobacco. Likes to hang out room 5, has repeatedly awakened guests at 3 o'clock in the morning by shaking the bed. Then there's the ghost of Rosie. Rosie is believed to be a previous housekeeper who enjoyed moving guests' keys around. A visitor can know when Rosie's present by the smell of old-fashioned rose petals. And if we go to Las Vegas, the hotel that was known as the Aladdin for much of its life was the first major casino to open on the Las Vegas Strip in the 1960s. But throughout its history, it's been known by the name of number of names and had a number of owners. And there were many who claimed this hotel has always had a cloud hanging over it as well as its owners. Originally opened in 1963 as the Tally Ho. 1964 became known as the King's Crown. But it failed within 6 months when it wasn't able to get a gaming license. 1966, the new and improved Aladdin Hotel Casino was opened with a very upscale Aladdin Nights theme. Now, there are a number of interesting stories told about this hotel and casino. Many guests complained during the night they heard the sounds of key being inserted in the door lock and whispering coming from the hallway. Of course, like most hotels in Vegas, the room doors use electronic cards, not keys, and the old-fashioned locks hadn't been used in years. Many of these stories of haunting seem to revolve around the panorama suite on the 7th floor. According to many, visitors staying in the panorama suite have also heard strange whisperings and the sound of a key being inserted in the door lock. It also had, the Aladdin now being demolished, a door buzzer which rings at the oddest hours. When the door is answered, of course, there's never anybody there. Items have also been known to vanish from the suite and reappear in other places. You never know what you're going to encounter when you stay in some of these historic old buildings. Well, we've come to the end of today's show. We've run out of time. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll be talking about other haunted hotels in Las Vegas. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.